Hello and welcome to A Little Too Quiet, the Ferndale Library podcast, brought to you by the Friends of the Ferndale Library. That was my best NPR voice. I'm so proud.
I love that for you.
My name is Mary Graham.
And I'm Erin.
And today we are talking to the one and only Sasha Lamb, author of When the Angels Left the Old Country, which has won a Stonewall Award and a Sidney Taylor Award and a bunch of other awards because it's a really good book.
Honestly, it's like the best book ever.
You may remember this book from me talking about it in our Best of 2023 episode.
And I also loved it and wanted to talk about it during that episode. But I was told that Mary Graham, no, actually, we talked about it.
It was a conversation.
We had a conversation. No, we did talk about who was going to be able to do this because we both wanted to talk about this book so much. And I'm very happy that now we've had a chance to go and talk to Sasha about the book. And I'm very excited about their upcoming book. It's going to be a great conversation, I think.
Yeah, so we are going to cut over to our conversation with Sasha Lamb. Hi, so I'm Mary Graham.
And I'm Erin. We're both youth librarians here at the Ferndale Area District Library.
Yeah. And I think you and I were actually at Simmons at the same time and never crossed paths.
That may well be true. I was there from around 2015 to 2020.
Okay, I was there 2018 to 2020.
So we definitely overlapped, but yeah. I may have been over in the archival silo.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you may have been doing archive and history stuff while I was like toiling away in the public library side of things. So we are so happy to have you with us. We're just so excited to have you here to talk about When the Angels Left the Old Country and also a little bit about your upcoming book. So for the listeners at home who may not have yet taken my advice and read your book, a book that I shove into the hands of all of my friends, can you give us about what the premise of When the Angels Left the Old Country is about?
Yes. So When the Angels Left the Old Country is my debut novel, and it's what I describe as an Ellis Island era immigrant fairy tale. It stars an angel and a demon who are Talmud study partners in a small village in Poland. But then a girl from the village goes missing on her way to America, and they have to find out what happened.
It was so good.
Honestly, we had a podcast episode at the end of last year, and we were talking about our favorite books. And we both, Mary Graham and I, had mentioned that that was one of our favorites.
Yeah, we had to like check with each other because we did, Jeff did like this patchwork of, 5-minute interviews with each of us about what our favorite books were and put it all together. And I had to poke my head over Aaron's cubicle and be like, we're not doing the same book, right? We got to like organize.
Yeah, we had to coordinate to make sure we did it.
Well, because you were the one who had me read the book. Erin buys all of our young adult literature. And one thing I definitely want to talk about is Levine Garrido and work, because Erin, when new YA comes in that she thinks I'll like, will often set it aside for me as like, here's a Mary Graham book. And frankly, 9 times out of 10 at this point, it's a Levine Garrido book. So would you be willing to talk about just kind of like your path to publishing this novel and how you ended up with Levine?
Absolutely. I had a pretty smooth journey from writing to publication. It was unusually quick, partly because I knew who my dream agent was. And when I queried her, she came right back to me and said that she would love to represent the book. So I was quickly able to sign with an agent, and then we got it out on sub within a year. And Arthur Levine from Levine Garrido actually came back with a preempt, which is where you sign a contract with an editor and agree not to continue on submission and not to take it to auction, which obviously not going to auction means you might not get as much in a cash advance, but it does get you more quickly through the process of submission. And because it was Arthur Levine, and I really was very excited at the opportunity to do that, and I wanted to be with Levine Garrido for a few reasons. One is they had such a lineup already, even as a very new publisher. I think they just turned 5 years old. And so they were 3 years old when I signed with them. And they already had so many books that were winning a lot of awards and that would show up on staff picks at my local indies and whatnot. So I thought, oh, I get to be on a shelf with Darcy Little Badger, you know. And yeah, each book on their list gets so much attention from the team. Every single member of the team is so engaged in making sure that every book gets its fair amount of attention and gets sent to librarians and bloggers and booksellers, and they're really great. It's been great working with them.
That is absolutely fabulous. It makes me very happy to hear, because, you know, we follow the state of publishing and in general, and sometimes I look at things and I'm like, whew, it seems brutal out there. But, you know, something I've been so impressed by with Levine Corrido is just the consistency of, like, everything we get in from them across the age span that they do is such high quality. It makes me very happy.
Yeah, I think it's that just every single person who's involved is really dedicated to making sure that the books are the best that they can be. And that's really great, because there's only so much you can do as an author by yourself. At a certain point, you stop seeing any flaws or even stop seeing the good parts of your own work, mm-hmm. and have a team that's dedicated to making sure that your vision is realized in ways that you might not even necessarily be able to do with your own eyes on your own work. That really helps a lot.
I have to ask, now that we've kind of talked a little bit about, like, how you got into the publishing, what was your inspiration, and how did you, like, where did the idea for When Angels Left the Old Country, like, how did that come to be in your mind?
So there's sort of two elements that came together to make up the story. One is my background in history. I finished my Simmons Archives and History dual degree around 2019-2020, which is also when I wrote this manuscript. And I wrote my master's thesis in history about Jewish women's immigrant aid in the 1920s. So I had all of this background research on the immigration system and migration to the United States and the obstacles that stood in people's way. And that immigration story is very familiar to many people, both in the Jewish community and in other ethnic communities in the United States. So it's a story that resonates a lot with a lot of people. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to combine that kind of collective memory of migration with an actual fairy tale element, bring in some supernatural characters and supernatural forces to the story. And I brought that in with the characters of the angel and the demon, who were the other of the two core ideas. And it was, what would it be like if you had this Talmud study partnership, which can be a very intimate relationship? It's someone that you might see every day, and you argue with them and you figure out the problems of life together. What would it be like if you had that partnership and they were an angel and a demon? So they have these different perspectives from a supernatural point of view. They have different takes on how the universe should work and how it does work and what should be done about that. So I put them into the migration story, and it all really came together almost on its own. It had a lot of vitality to it, and the relationship between those two characters really had a lot of momentum to it because of the way that they kind of push and pull against each other, and they make decisions in different ways, and it kind of pulls the plot along in a really great way. So the manuscript was pretty easy from start to finish. It took me probably less than 2 months to actually write, and then obviously I had to do some editing and redrafting, but the original idea stayed pretty much intact.
That's amazing for me to hear, because, like, especially the relationship between the angel and the demon in the book is just one of my favorite parts. Like, the give and take, the push and the pull, and just how they have such different opinions, but at the same time, there's so much that they can relate to each other about things. I loved that. And fascinating, like, it all just, like, came out so quickly.
I loved that part as well, but I, as a labor and union history nerd, was also absolutely thrilled by the labor and union history. And I texted, in convincing one of my friends to read it, I texted her and I was like, Alana, you're never going to believe this. This, you know, Jewish novel set in the early 20th century in New York has labor union. And she was like, oh my God, I've never been less surprised about anything in my life. And she actually has a question that she wanted me to ask you, which is she has some familiarity with Yiddish and wanted to know about your process for the sort of like Yiddish inflections that the prose has, because she was absolutely delighted by even just the grammatical structure of reading it and being like, hey, wait a minute, this is a Yiddish novel. It made her very, very happy. And so she wanted to know about your process working that into the prose. Was it there from the beginning?
It was, yeah. I had the narrator's voice in mind pretty strongly from the start. And I was inspired by a lot of classic Yiddish literature, which I've read mostly in translation. So Sholem Aleichem and Isaac Bashevis Singer, and Isaac Bashevis Singer's older sister, Esther, who's a little less well-known, but she also wrote a great novel about being an intellectually frustrated young woman living in a patriarchal society. And for the English with Yiddish inflection, there's an author called Anzia Yezierska who wrote in the 1920s, and she kind of had a brief moment of fame when one of her books was adapted into a Hollywood movie, but then she was kind of lost and forgotten. And she wrote in this very interesting kind of Yiddishized English idiom. And I took a lot of inspiration from her. And since a lot of people don't know her name, I like to give her a shout out for that, because I think that is something that is quite unique about the narrator's voice here. And I probably wouldn't have come up with the idea if it weren't for Anzia Yezierska doing it first.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that I am such a big fan of narrators with strong voices where like the narrator isn't, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily first person, or they're not necessarily a character in the story, but they are their own character.
It's got its own style.
Yeah, and that's something that I feel like we come across less in a lot of contemporary literature. So one of the fastest ways that my friends can get me to read a book is saying like, oh, the narrator is doing fascinating things. And I'm like, give it here. So something else that I and a lot of my friends have also admired, particularly my other non-Jewish friends, is how little is actually explained in this book, because so much of it is within this community where everybody's going to understand each other. And so it doesn't get an explanation. And I did so much side research while reading this book to be like, oh, like, I know what the Talmud is, but I'm not familiar with like what this section is about. What is this? And I would go away and research that. And I don't think I really even have a question. I just wanted to say I loved that. And this sense of like, I felt trusted as a reader to be like, do you figure it out? Because it wouldn't make sense in world to explain it. I just really enjoyed that.
I'm glad that you use the word trust, because that was really something that I wanted, was to extend trust to the reader and believe in the reader's ability to follow along with the story, even if you're not familiar with all of the cultural context or all of the words. And obviously we do have a glossary in the back to make it a little bit easier, but I feel sometimes if there's too much explanation, it feels a little unwelcoming. It kind of creates distance between the reader and the narrator. And I prefer to be welcomed in and sort of extended that level of trust, and, you know, kind of be invited into a cultural space rather than held at arm's length in any way. So yeah, that's great. I'm glad that worked.
And I think at the same time, I mean, my Jewish friends who have read it have also felt very welcomed, because they feel like they're an assumed reader. Like they read it and it's kind of like, you know, on The Good Place. Yes, the time knife. We've all seen it. and they're like, cool. Like it's not presumed that it's, you know, not an assumed non-Jewish reader who would need everything explained to them. They were like, oh no, this is cool. Cool. We got it. We're going on. Great.
By assuming, it means like there's no like otheringness of it. And I think that was, for me, I came in not knowing very much about like Jewish culture at all, and I learned so much. It was so fascinating, and it was also presented to me in a way it was like, I didn't feel like I was being hit over the hammer with like learning all these new things. It just was very natural how it kind of all got included there. And it made for a really interesting read just from that perspective, not even counting going into the characters and everything else in the novel, just having that kind of like layer to it was so interesting.
And I felt like it was made with so much love. Like, I mean, I think you talk in your author's note, but especially, you know, as a love letter to, you know, the Jewish novels of the time, the Yiddish novels of the time, that like where it takes place. It just, there's a reason it was my favorite book of 2023. It just made me very happy. So
what I want to know now is, like, when you're writing, like, what's your process? Because clearly you write this with a lot of love and care and attention. Like, how do you set yourself up to write like that, do you think? Like, do you have a particular process that you like to do? Or how do you go about writing such a beautiful book?
Well, I am not an outliner. At all, pretty much, which is a little bit unusual for especially a book that has so many elements. What I tend to do is actually start with the beginning of the story and write through to the end. And then in edits, I go back and fix any false starts and add in foreshadowing and things like that. But what I tend to do is I read a lot just for fun, both fiction and nonfiction, and lots of history and lots of folklore. And then I have all this research inspiration in my head, and it usually takes a little while before things kind of coalesce into the core of a story idea. And when they coalesce, I can feel when an idea becomes something that is going to have movement. And it usually starts with some characters and a situation that has some inherent conflict. So with angels, it was the angel and the demon, who are Talmud study partners. So there's already some inherent conflict there, but then the additional element of movement of what's going to push them out of their comfortable space was going to America. And then that kind of naturally leads you through an arc so that a situation becomes a story. And yeah, so it's research that's not necessarily done intending to use it for something that I already have an idea for, but just broad reading that comes together to form ideas. And then I can usually recognize when an idea is going to have a plot that works. And that's how I sit down and actually start writing, at that beginning point where I've identified a moment of tension and see how that tension will resolve over time.
Yeah, when you said that it took about 2 months to do the first draft of Angels, I thought, yeah, but you know, you've got what, 5 years of history, like high level history work behind you. So I completely sort of understand that, like, that, you know, sort of, I think sounds like it front loads the research work. But then once you get to the writing, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, but aha, we've already, you know, you've already got it, and can pull a lot of stuff in.
Yeah.
So
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's sort of invisible work, or work that doesn't know what it's leading up to until the moment where I see that little scene that's going to lead me somewhere. And then I say, oh, that's what I've been researching for all this time.
Yeah. I've heard some authors call that like writing as discovery, like some mm-hmm. other authors I really enjoy who do the same sort of thing where they sit down and they're like, all right, we've got a premise, like, let's see where it goes. That's always, as someone who also is not outlining, has never gone anywhere for me, I'm like, oh, that just makes it sound like fun, like do, we're gonna sit down and just see what happens.
Yeah.
So
when you were writing,
sometimes you do end up with false starts, but you always have editing to trim them back. And once you figure out where you're going, you can put in a setup for what actually happens. But yes,
when you were writing it, did you like already have the idea that you wanted it to be a YA book, or did you like just kind of let the story flow where it was and then be like, hey, I think this would be great specifically for like this audience?
I am a big YA reader and sort of had the idea that it was YA from the start. And actually my agent said she thought it would work for either adult or YA. It's a book with a lot of crossover potential there. But I wanted to pitch children's literature editors first when we took it on sub, partly because I have some other projects that are more firmly YA, and partly because I think that teens deserve to have complicated books that really make them think. And if teens are engaged in books that can keep them reading for a long time and keep them thinking really hard about what they've read, that's how you end up with adults who like to read. So pitching it to children's literature editors first was a reflection of my belief in the power of the teen reader and wanting to prioritize them.
Wahoo.
That's so nice yeah. to hear.
That's, I mean, that's part of why I went to Simmons specifically, is because even though I didn't do the double children's literature MA and MList program, I had a lot of friends who did. And I went there specifically because I knew I could get a really good, I wanted to be a public children's librarian. And I was like, I will go there and find people who believe in public libraries and children's literature. And yay, that just makes me really happy. Yeah,
I think that teen readers deserve books with depth and complexity, and they can handle those books. And that is how you are going to create readers for the future. Once they leave school, you want them to still want to read. And that's mm-hmm. It's your yeah. last chance to capture them.
Yeah. Well, and teenagers also already have such a complex experience. Like, you know, I think that I think you're absolutely right. And additionally, I think that you keep teenagers as readers when you give them books written for them that already reflect, you know, that they are. I mean, I think John Green likes to say, stop telling teenagers how smart they're not, you know.
I think that a lot of people look at teen readers and think they're still children and we have to protect them from certain difficult ideas or from things that might hurt them to read about. And the fact is that kids are already encountering all of the difficult things that exist in life, and reading about them in a book where you can just put it down when it gets too hard, it's going to help you deal with things that you then encounter in real life, or that you have already encountered in real life and don't know how to deal with them. So absolutely, yes. There's an instinct to shelter young people that I think is a little bit out of touch with the reality of the experiences they actually already are having. Mm-hmm. So
sure. I like to think of it sometimes a little bit of like when you go and you have like a kid and you go and you're like, okay, I have to keep them in this bubble and protect them from all the germs, and then like they're not prepared for when they're put out into the real world and they get all these different germs coming at them, and you know, the whole issue, like going and letting them just experience the things in the books and not trying to shelter them away from the experiences. They themselves like to be treated like adults because they don't feel like children anymore. And I think respecting that and giving them the opportunity to have these experiences instead of trying to shelter them really makes a huge difference in their lives.
And I think you're completely right, too, about the kind of distance that a book can afford if it's something that you can put down and walk away from and take a lap. And I have very clear memories of encountering, like, difficult situations and feelings through literature when I was a teenager, and it was good for me. And we run book clubs for a number of ages here at this library, and something that we talk about even with our youngest kids is, you know, if you don't like a book, or if a book is somehow upsetting you, you can always put it down. You know, the library is not, you're not getting a grade on if you finish it or how quickly you read it. And that always goes over well. Since you've been mentioning folk and fairy tales, and Angels very much does feel like a fairy tale. That's a great segue into another friend who read this book on my recommendation. wanted to know if there were any fairy tales in particular that inspired you, or just ones that you want to tell people to go look up that you think more people should know. And they also asked me to pass on that reading this book felt like, I think they said, it almost feels like it wasn't written. I mean that in the best way possible. It felt as though I was being told this story by somebody's very funny grandmother. So they loved that part, but they were very particularly enchanted with the fairy tale aspect of it.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a specific individual fairy tale off the top of my head, but I read a lot of collections of Jewish folk tales. There are several collections that were put together by a guy called Howard Schwartz. One is called Leaves from the Garden of Eden, and I think one is called Elijah's Violin. And they're Jewish folk tales from all over the world. So not just Eastern European, but North African, Persian. And those collections are great. Some of them are out of print and a little harder to get, but check your libraries for Howard Schwartz. They're really good. I like his translations. And there's just a lot of, you know, fairy tales are so diverse and they reflect the cultures that they come from. So with Jewish folk and fairy tales, what's interesting is that you have the Jewishness, but then you also have the culture that those Jewish communities lived among. So you have sort of inflections of different other folklores layered with the Jewish folklore. And I think that's just really neat to see all together. I really like The Fairy Princess of Ergetz, which is a story where a guy gets lost on a ship and lands on an island of fairies, and they are Jewish fairies, but also they want to eat him because they are fairies. And the fairy rabbi has to say, no, we have to have the Torah service before we eat him.
Classic fairy tale.
I'm gonna look this up immediately. Yeah, I feel like I came across, I did a storytelling class in grad school, and we had to do some evaluations of fairy tale collections, and I think I came across some Howard Schwartz for that. So anybody who is listening to this podcast and is curious, go talk to your librarian about the 398.2s, and they can give you a hand with that. I'm going to go look up some of those myself. Those sound really interesting.
I love it when you get a nice, dark kind of fairy tale. There's a little bit of like, kind of a moment to it. They're so fun. Fairy tales, I think, they get overlooked sometimes, and they bring so much joy to my little dark heart.
And I mean, talk about things that people have looked at and gone, oh, we can't tell the children those. We'll have to revise them, you know. Mm-hmm. when in fact, I mean, earlier this week, a little 5-year-old child back in our youth department clutched a book to their chest and said, I want blood. They had just gotten a book about the circulatory system and they were very excited. And the number of kids we get in that are like, where are your scariest graphic novels? Is many. So those kids are going to grow up into delightful dark YA readers, and I can't wait. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any like YA books that you've read recently, either fantasy or otherwise, that have been really good for you, Sasha?
I recently reread one of my Lambda cohort fellows, Jazz Hammonds's debut, We Deserve Monuments. That's a really great contemporary YA. It's about a girl who moves with her parents down from DC to a small town in Georgia where her grandmother is ill and dying, and her grandmother and mother have had this really difficult relationship, and the town is full of all these secrets, and it's an excellent book that I just read for the second time. Another Jewish fantasy, there's The City Beautiful by Aidan Polydoros, which is set during the Chicago exhibition in 1893, and it's got murder and horror and labor rights and immigration, and it's a great story.
we're doing one of Aidan Polydoros's books for younger readers at, we have an LGBTQ book club for 4th through 8th graders, so we're doing The Ring of Solomon in May, and I'm very excited for that one.
Excellent. Yes, I enjoyed that. I'm reading one now that's not out yet. I'm not sure exactly when it comes out, but Ariel Vishny's debut, which is about Jewish vampire girls.
Ooh.
And I forget the title off the top of my head, but I can grab it in a second. It's set in New York. It's got Yiddish theater. Night Owls.
Excellent.
It comes out in the fall.
I think I have that in a cart.
I was going to say, Aaron, put that one in a cart. And listeners, go put in your purchase requests at your library.
Night Owls by Ariel Vishny.
Marvelous.
That does sound really good.
And you have a book coming out this fall, don't you?
Yeah,
I do. My second novel will be out October 1st. It is called The Forbidden Book. And the premise is that it's set in a small city in the Pale of Settlement during the 1870s. And on the night before her wedding, a young bride leaps out the window and runs away from her life, takes on a male identity. But it turns out that the name that she's using actually belongs to a real person, and people want him dead.
Oh.
I'm here for it. I believe a knife is also involved, which is any of my coworkers can tell you. The minute something, I read Laura E. Weymouth's A Consuming Fire a couple of years ago, and we had her on the pod, which was fabulous. And I just, for the whole week I was reading it, was going around the back office going, bone, knife, bone, knife, bone, knife.
Can't confirm.
Well, I'm so excited for The Forbidden Book.
Yeah.
And
I was wondering, so has writing this new book been like a different writing experience compared to When Angels Left the Old Country for you? Or has it been like, yeah, another 2 months, bam, it's done?
It was very different. And part of what made it different was that because Angels had such an overwhelmingly positive response and received multiple awards and quite a lot of attention for a debut, I felt pretty intimidated. Like, I had a hard act to follow, and I was struggling for a while with just knowing that this was going to be a different story, but wanting it to be the best version of itself, and not wanting to try to be too much like Angels, but also not wanting to trip myself up trying to be too different. So it took me a little while to get in the groove. But once I did finally get through the drafting process, again, kind of quickly, but it was a quick draft after a couple of years of kind of poking at it and really trying to get over my own emotional blocks about expectation. And what really helped was saying Angels is a quite a big story. It's like the story of anyone who came through Ellis Island in a way. And for The Forbidden Book, I went much more specific. I took it to a less familiar period of history. It's set entirely within the Pale of Settlement, and it's all in this one town, and it's about the sort of very specific concerns of everyone in that town and how they feel about their little part of the world that no one outside of that part of the world cares about at all. And that helped because it was like, okay, I now have something that's very different from Angels while at the same time having all of the elements that I really enjoy, which is the queerness and the historical and the supernatural as well. There are some angels in it, but they're a different type of angel from the one in When the Angels Left the Old Country.
Oh, this is great. This is hooray.
I'm looking forward to, because like you said before, like, it was such a big thing for the first one, and this is so much more zoomed in. I'm looking forward to seeing that come across in the writing of this next book. It's going to be fantastic.
Well, and even just with the whole girl dressing as a boy thing, I feel like I'm going to have to, like, watch Yentl first and then, like, do, like, a double feature.
Yes, I think the Yentl comparison is going to come up. Absolutely. I did, in tribute to the original short story of Yentl, there are some details of the physical appearance of the protagonist that are Yentl.
Excellent. So listeners, go read the short story first and then keep an eye out for all those.
You can read Yentl and The Dybbuk, and then you will be prepared for The Forbidden Book. The Dybbuk is a play from the early 20th century that really kind of stands as a major pillar of the Jewish supernatural in fiction. So it kind of felt a little bit like, especially as a queer writer, because there's some interesting gender stuff and interesting sexuality stuff going on in the Dybbuk, I felt almost obligated to do a take on the Dybbuk. And the Forbidden Book has elements of definitely both that and Yentl.
Yeah, this is less of a question, but more of a thank you for, I have to say, like, how you have handled, like, gender and queerness in When Angels Left the Old Country, and apparently now also in your new book, is just, I love that, and I want to thank you for such beautiful representation. I think it was so interesting and well done in the first book. And so thank you for writing about that and writing it how you did.
I have a real soft spot for women characters who look at their best friends in fiction who are also women and go, why am I so mad that she's getting married? And then later go, oh, like, that's very near and dear to my heart. My friend Alana's gonna scream when she hears this because she loves the Dybbuk. And so when I send her this episode and she's like, the new novel, it has she's gonna lose her mind. It's gonna be great. I absolutely agree with Erin in that, I don't know, there's so much about Angels that is refreshing, and something that brings me so much joy about it is that it's refreshing, but it also has so many historical ties. Like, it's so rooted in history that actually happened, in literature that already exists. So as a queer person, I just felt very connected to, you know, family throughout history. It was great.
Yeah, that was definitely one of my goals, was to have the queerness be very rooted in history and not feel anachronistic. And for that, I did do a lot of reading about people who lived queer lives during that period of history. And I have to shout out the anthology of queer Jewish texts called A Rainbow Thread, edited by Noam Siena, it goes all the way back to the Talmud and up to 1969. And it's a collection of incidences of queerness that show up in the historical record within the Jewish community. And I also read a few others. One that I'll mention that was very useful to me was Female Husbands by Jen Mannion, which is about people assigned female at birth who lived masculine lives, and many of them were discovered due to death or illness that they were quote unquote really a woman all the time, but they were married to women, and we know of at least one of them who went through the immigration system at Ellis Island under the male identity and was only discovered later. And if we know of one, then there could have been more who were never discovered. And I like to think about those sort of invisible roots below the surface of the queer history that didn't get recorded, but we have examples that made it into the historical record, and then we can sort of extrapolate from there what kinds of lives people might have been living. And that was the approach that I was taking with Angels, was the idea of, like, these wouldn't have been recorded, but they could have been out there. Mm-hmm. Like, these could have happened. These lives could have been lived.
Yeah, I love wonderful. The shining of a light on that. It's something that I don't think, you know, obviously they don't teach it so much in schools, especially if, like, you're in Florida or something like that. But it's such an important part of history. And the fact that, you know, we're seeing that in a lot of books these days where people, especially teens, can see that, I think, is just such a wonderful thing.
And it's also just interesting, you know, life is a rich tapestry. So I'm so glad that Angels exists and that I can keep foisting it on all of my friends. And I will do the same with the Forbidden Book, which won't even be that hard of a sell, because most of them are going to be texting me and being like, when is that one out again? When can I put it on pre-order? So,
yeah, you can be guaranteed that once our copy arrives from Baker and Taylor, before it goes on the shelf, I may have finished reading it.
Yeah, we were just talking today about, like, oh, you know, a lot of the times Baker and Taylor will send us stuff before the street date, and, you know, we won't put it out till the street date, but we're like, oh, oh no, we will have already read it by the time it goes on the shelf.
My hand slipped and the book just opened up to the first chapter.
I totally didn't become a librarian just for early access to books that have come out.
I mean, I only read in advance because I need to be able to inform the public about what books they should read and give readers advisory, Mary Grant.
I know. We're just, oh my goodness. Such suffering public servants. All out, folks. Erin, did you have any further questions?
Oh, I think like the last thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was, you know, zooming all the way kind of like back to the back of the beginning of this interview. You know, you're talking about Simmons. I would love to know more, like, what inspired you to get your librarian degree?
I actually kind of wanted to be a librarian since I was a kid, which is kind of unusual. Sometimes people are like, how did you know you wanted to be a librarian when you were a child? But I did. Part of it was that I just love organizing. And I love organizing information. And when I was in college getting my undergraduate degree in history, I thought I really enjoy the research, but I don't really enjoy writing the papers. And wouldn't it be great if I could help other people do research and just do the research part? And then that became the idea of being an archivist librarian, because I get to help other people do their research and I don't have to do the part where I'm writing the paper that then has to undergo peer review, which makes me feel very nervous. But I can write fiction, which is a little less, you know, I try to be very accurate with my fiction, but it doesn't need to be completely factually backable up. And so I got the history and archives dual degree partly because I wanted to keep having fun doing more historical research, and partly because that program at Simmons it's great because you see archives from two sides. You're seeing what's it like as an archivist facilitating research for others, and then as a researcher, when you go into an archives, how do you interact with it, and what kind of things show up from the side of the researcher that you might not have noticed from the side of the archivist. So I found that very useful.
You touched right in my heart when you were talking about organizing information.
Yeah, you and I joined the library profession for basically the same reasons. I was an English literature major in undergrad and was like, well, I don't want an MA or a PhD in English literature because the writing the papers was fine, but working on my honors thesis, which I did on adaptations of Shakespeare in young adult literature, I was like, I feel like at this point I don't have much to say beyond, isn't this really cool, guys? Isn't this really cool?
As a librarian,
that's your job.
Cool? You should read it.
Exactly. So I was like, oh, I don't have to like try to tie this into like literary theory, which, you know, was again good for 4 years of undergrad, but I was like, so beyond this, we're going to go to the geek side of things where I can just be like, guys, look what I found.
Let's just do the fun stuff.
very much stuck to the sort of public services side of the MList degree at Simmons, but I did very much enjoy my intro to cataloging class, and I love telling people, if you want to see library students almost come to blows, just swing by an intro to cataloging class at any local library school. And people are like, surely, aren't you guys like quiet and you don't have strong opinions about things? And I was like, exact opposite.
Catalog class.
Exact opposite.
Is it more important to shelve this under this, or is it more important to shelve it under that?
Yeah.
Or where are people going to look for this book?
Yes. And it's obvious, and it's you know, you'll be in class and you'll be like, well, obviously you shelve it under this. And your classmates are like, are you mad? You shelve it under that.
No, my cataloging class, we had a saying, if you've got five people working together to catalog something, you're going to have five different ways of cataloging the thing.
Yeah.
I have different ways of cataloging books in my own home, on my own shelves. Sometimes I'm like, why didn't I put it this place? I should have put it over here with these books.
Yeah. Yes. People sometimes ask me how I organize my home books, and they're like, oh, is it by this or by that? And I'm like, well, A, it's about which books will fit physically on which of my shelves. And then B, It's a secret cataloging system that only I know, but I know it, and I'm the only audience, so that's all that matters.
Exactly. I have a strong feeling about personal libraries, which is that if you want to organize your books by color, that's fine, because you know what color your book is.
Exactly.
You can find it.
Yep.
Yes.
You only have to have one, maybe two, depending on who lives with you. Only a few people need to know.
Exactly.
Mine are chronological, in case you're wondering, by last order of from first read through most current read, so that way I know when it's time to revisit
that
a friend.
That is fascinating. I have never heard of anyone cataloging their books that way before. When I was away at college, I would sometimes ask my mother to bring me a book the next time she saw me, and I would be able to visualize in my childhood bedroom where it was. I would say, you know, it's this shelf, third shelf up, all the way to the right, and she'd be like, how do you... How?
That's
like,
where it goes.
But that's where it goes, Mom. That's where it lives.
There's a method to the madness.
Yeah, so we are sort of a long-term cataloging project in our youth department is that we're getting rid of the Dewey Decimal System because Melville Dewey, thumbs down. It's whenever I am telling non-library friends, they're like, oh, was he like... hashtag problematic. I'm like, do you know how hard you have to try to get canceled in the early 20th century as a white man in America? And he managed it.
I could do a whole podcast about how much I hate
how. But also, you know, thinking about where are people going to look for this, when kids want to know where the animal books are, they do not think separately about wild versus domestic. Which, for listeners who don't know, there are two separate sections for wild versus domesticated animals in the Dewey Decimal System. And most children in Michigan don't get decimal education, I think, until third or fourth grade as well. So, you know, they come in and they're like, what does this even mean? So we're working on some whole word subject classification. Our committee of four has managed it without any brawls breaking out, which I think is very mature of us. That's... We're excited about that. I'm excited.
I'm always excited about it.
Yeah. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't asked you about?
I think we covered a lot. And I just want to say thank you for making all of your friends read my book.
Absolutely. That's truly actually the true reason that I got into library science. It's like, yeah, helping people find things. Great. Whatever. Early access to books, slightly higher up. Getting to just talk about things I like until the people around me succumb and partake in them, top reason. Top. Most of Jeff, who is, you know, off screen and working away on the podcast notes, there he is, can tell you that most of these podcasts start with somebody who works at this library coming up to him and being like, I'm going to bother you about this thing that I like until we do a podcast about it.
I think that's even maybe a little bit of how this came to be was we were just like,
oh, yeah, you and I were like hey, Jeff.
Wouldn't it be so cool if we could just talk to Sasha? Like, yeah, hey, we were like, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff, surely he made it happen. So thank you so much for coming to being on the pod.
Thank you. It's wonderful to talk to librarians always. And I am excited to hear some of your other interviews and see what other authors have been talking about with you.
Wow, wasn't that such a great conversation with Sasha?
I hope the listener could tell how big I was smiling through that whole conversation. I have a huge book list now. I have things I've got to go put on hold.
Some of those classic fairy tales I like had not heard of, and I definitely want to read.
Classic fairy tales, early 20th century Jewish authors. I am so excited. I'm so excited. And that was... such a great conversation. I loved the insight they gave us into their writing process. I do have to say, as a Simmons alum in Southeast Michigan, surrounded by U of M and Wayne State graduates, fine schools,
Woo.
Yeah, go Wayne State, go Warriors. The place of my undergraduate degree, lots of love and affection for it, but it's also
you like talking to Simmons.
I like talking to Simmons folks. It's fun.
Well, I'm glad you got to, I loved talking to them about their experience going through library school and their writing process and just everything, frankly.
It was, organizing information.
Oh, it's beautiful. So. Yeah, I think that's all we have today. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening to another episode of A Little Too Quiet, the Ferndale Library Podcast, which is brought to you, of course, by the Friends of the Ferndale Library. We also thank John Duffy for giving us music to open and close each episode. If you want to find out more information about supporting this podcast, visit ferndalefriends.org. Please also remember to rate, review, subscribe, and if you leave us a positive review, you know, we can find more listeners and they can all hear this beautiful interview we just did. We'll be back next week with more. Thanks again for listening.
Bye.